Freestyling the anchor, I'll write that shit. Freestyling the anchor, anchor. Freestyling the anchor, I'll write that shit. Freestyling the anchor. Hey, hey.
Yo, yo.
This is Ergo.
It is indeed.
I'm Kiss.
I'm Damon.
And what we do here is reshape culture for the more liberatory and creative.
And we got a treat for y'all. A true supernova, a genius, and a humble soul. We got Prentice Hemphill today.
Whew. Yeah, no, we were fangirling hard on this one, I would say.
Geek, blushing.
You know? No, blushing hard.
You a little more than I.
We were so glad to get to chop it up and really get to know Prentice a little bit. For those of y'all listening, I imagine many of you are familiar with their work as the host of Finding Our Way, a wonderful podcast, the founding visionary of the Embodiment Institute, and just really like one of the predominant thinkers, wrestlers, unpackers of what does it mean to heal together? What is the role of the collective in healing? And what are the ways that we can move through conflict toward new liberatory possibilities? You know, kind of like our
it's
shit
our,
over
our
here.
Jam.
You
it's
know?
Our jam. And for those who aren't familiar with Prentice, what a gift this is. I mean, Prentice is truly a thought leader or thought steward in the space of somatic healing. How do we find the way trauma and growth are rooted in the body and the importance of practice and ritual as a way to maintain healthily within community and collective structures?
And we got into some like old person grouching about the world and like, you know, the kids these days. But I think that was all in generative directions. You know what I mean?
As an appreciator of words, also, I just have to say, excellent vocabulary.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
Watch the gems they drop.
Killing it. All right. You can find Prentice's work at PrenticeHemphill.com. Go to TheEmbodimentInstitute.org. Subscribe to Finding Our Way wherever you get your podcasts. There haven't been new episodes for a while, but they're in the process of reworking it. And there'll be new things coming soon over there. And make sure you pre-order What It Takes to Heal, Prentice's new book on how transforming ourselves can change the world. It is available for pre-order now. And of course, you should, you know, comment, subscribe, review Ergo wherever you get your pods. Same place you get Prentice's. Follow us at Ergo Radio, at Respair Media. Dig back in the archive. Oh, and we're on the road this year.
So stay tuned for screenings of the 1 Million Experiments film coming to a city near you. And if it's not coming to a city near you, hit us up and maybe we can make it happen.
Yeah, we're going to be in New York in April. We're going to be in Seattle in July. Got a bunch of other things coming all over this land and beyond. So get in touch with us. Contact at RespairMedia.com if you want to bring this wonderful invitation into abolitionist movement into your space, and catch the trailer in the show notes. All right, I think that's it. With that said, let's get into it with Prentice Hemphill.
Yeah.
We are fortunate and privileged today to be sharing space with such an amazing thought leader, really a guide for so many of us of how we want to be in this space of transformation and liberation. We are grateful and excited to have Prentice Hemphill in the building. So we do our own sound effects.
That is one of the greatest intros that I have had ever, I think.
Yeah.
So thank
wow.
you for that.
That's high praise.
That's what we're here for. We have already won. This is a success. So we're going to get right to it. We know that you are also a fan of traditions, but we have a tradition of how we start every conversation, and it's a two-part question. And that question is centered around time. And so define time however you will. That could be this hour, this day, this season, this lifetime. In this time, how is the world treating you, and how are you treating the world, Prentice Hemphill?
Oh, wow. How is the world treating me? I think there are all these pockets and portals that are opening up for me right now. And when I go into them, none of them is, they're not like comfortable pockets, but they are rewarding in terms of the kinds of transformation they offer. But I'm definitely in this period of like, okay, you want to look at that for real? Enter into this portal and I'll take you through all of your stuff. So yeah, the world feels like that right now. It's really changing me. And how am I in the world? I mean, I loved your introduction. And then I was thinking as you were offering it, I was like, wow, I messed up in one of my interpersonal relationships this week. And I was like, I don't know that I deserve this intro.
Yeah. Well, they didn't give you the intro. We did. You know, no, maybe they'd give you a different intro.
Everything's subjective, and you know, from where I stand, you ain't messed up with me. So we
take coming that down, coming up to the mic, this motherfucker. You know, really get into it.
And I've been working through it with people. So, I mean, there's that, you know, just feeling my edges. So, yes, we're all complex people and we all have shadows and mistakes. And I'm feeling some of that this week, the things I don't yet know about myself that I'm learning.
That's beautiful. Thank you for indulging and participating in our ritual, our opening question, which we've been doing for a long, long time. As I got to know your show, I was like very moved that you have your own opening tradition question that I think in some ways elicits some of the same thoughts of where are we now or where are we? And so in honoring your ritual of that, one, we can start with how you're thinking about that question for yourself. And also, I'm just curious of the evolution of that as a starting place. Like, where did that crystallize? Where did that question come to you as something to bring to these other people you're talking with?
Thank you for that, because that question is hardly ever reflected back to me. And now that you've done it, I can kind of feel, oh, there's a lot in there.
No, we get messed up anytime someone asks us how you treat the world. We're like, oh man, this is what we've been putting people through.
I look exactly. Like I'm like in a deposition or something. I'm like, well, if you refer to...
Exactly. It's funny because we are reworking the podcast and we're going to change the title of it and change the opening question. So this is actually really sweet to be able to reflect on that era of the podcast. You know, where are we right now? There is, for me, the way I'm looking at what's happening right now, I think there's so much going on. It feels like a moment of deep implication. Like I feel deeply implicated in everything that is happening. And I think for me, maybe for people who are living in Western countries in this moment, I talk about this a lot, but I'm feeling it a lot more now of like, can we allow ourselves not to be as good as we think we are? Can we be honest about who we are in the world? That doesn't mean that, you know, we're like hiding some sinister motivations or don't really believe in the things we say. But I'm really like, can I allow myself to let go of my clinging to goodness? I'm not even sure that I do it that much, but I think it's something that we inherit or is imposed on us, or, you know, all the myths that we have about who we are. And it feels like we're in a moment, it could be in a moment, depending on how you enter into it, of the kind of reckoning that makes you realize you're located somewhere differently than you thought you were. So that feels like a really destabilizing and a move towards a kind of honesty that, you know, just is. And, you know, I started asking people that question because I felt like, you know, when I started the podcast, it was the start of the kind of lockdown phase of the pandemic where everything was shutting down and it was unmooring. You know, people were like, what is going on? What is the world? Where am I? Who are we in relationship?
Well, literally.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Even though a lot of us, our lives were suddenly more narrow than they were, not for everyone, but for some of us, our lives are more narrow. And we're like, but where am I then? Where am I located? Who am I? You know, what community am I located in? And I felt this, I felt the need to just keep asking, not to like find one specific answer, but as a kind of orienting practice, you know, like what do we orient around? How do we decide where we are and what we're in relationship to? And maybe there's something more to this destabilizing moment than there's a lot of loss, but maybe there's an opportunity to reorient. And so that was kind of where the question came from.
It's interesting to hear you name that moment as destabilizing in that way. And then also in thinking about how you're feeling today and where we are today, this different type of destabilization, picking apart what you were saying about the like challenging sense of earned or moral goodness. Those are words I'm adding to it. But sometimes it's like, rarely I feel like it's like, oh no, I'm the opposite of what I thought. And usually it's like, I'm like 30% more down the spectrum of, you know, quote, good and bad than I thought.
Yeah.
And so I think the like abruptness you're talking about when you started asking that question of that was like the external rhythms of people's lives were, you know, shattered, disturbed, upended. And in this moment, at least for me, it feels like this, the cognitive dissonance of like the day-to-day external rhythms and spaces are still in practice and moving and the bus still comes and the store is open. That feels in some ways just as destabilizing that all of that could still be continuing right now. And so your work and your writing and your practice is about, you know, that this process of transformation isn't an individualist process. This is one that happens collectively. And so I'm wondering, how are you thinking about if the bus is still running, the stores are still open, and yet there's this collective hurt and pain happening right now? How are you starting to think about the implications of that? I know it's a vague, big question.
I really appreciate that image, though, of like, you know, the kind of insistence on normalcy or business as usual, even when things are crumbling. That's really evocative for me. And I think that's some of what feels so challenging in the external world and also in myself. It's like, how long will we hold on to this? What are the outer limits of, you know, how far we'll take this? And I can ask myself that question because I also have things that I want, if I'm very honest, things that I want to be stable. You know, I have a 2.5-year-old. I have a family. It's like there are things that I'm like, okay, I want to wake up and feel like there's a routine. And I also understand in this moment, witnessing so many people that don't have, it's almost empty even to say it like that, but you know, the relationship between my stability and someone else's instability, how do I live with that understanding?
It's like, how dare I think I deserve it?
Yeah. And how do we create, how much of our stability is a denial? What is actual stability that can reach across space and geographies? And that is a really big question that is, I think, hard for us to answer. But, you know, I've been thinking a lot about and practicing with, you know, our community around just what comes from witnessing, feeling, and right action, you know, like being an actual witness, a witness that is open and affected, a witness that is not, you know, that knows how to, in an embodied way, not centralize themselves, but leave themselves porous to the world. And then what are the kinds of actions that emerge from that porosity, that, you know, merging, for lack of a better word, but something that also retains your center. We're not just sort of giving ourselves over. I have a center and I'm open to this world. And what can come from that? I don't actually know. I'm on the edge of a lot of questions in my practice and just in my thinking. I'm like, what if we practice in this way? What will come of it? That's really where I'm located, is like really on the edge of things I thought I knew.
There's so many thoughts I have coming out of that. Like the way you talked about stability makes me think of the way we talk about safety, but I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. I might come back to it. I want to go deeper into practice and how practice has shown up for you personally, like how you actually practice. But I think you are also a public advocate, an ambassador, talker of practice, right? Like you be practicing. And I want to know when that crystallization of the intersection between somatic practice, embodiment, and collective movement space, liberation, resistance, transformation, in the more structural sense, when did it crystallize that convergence is like the intersection at which you want to do your work? And then how that shifted you in doing your own practices as you are publicly teaching, espousing, professing that this is a necessity, not only for our beings, but for our freedom making.
Wow, what a good question. I want to keep that question on my desk. So I can keep coming back to it.
We'll get you a transcript.
It's here for you.
Thank you. You know, a lot of people did a lot of work before me. So I enter into a lineage and into a path of politicized somatics. I was trained into politicized somatics. So to understand trauma politically is kind of how I came into it. And there, you know, I also trained to be a therapist.
Are you a disciple of Alta?
Yeah, sure. I'll take that. Alt is a dear, dear friend and also on our methodology team at the Embodiment Institute and someone I've taught with for the last decade. So yeah, she's a dear, dear one to me, the Oracle. But yeah, I was sort of taught about that connection. When I went to grad school to become a therapist, there was on the periphery, if I sought it out, there were people having conversations about community and wellness. And so those lineages exist And, you know, when I started to get deeper into them, I was probably threading other things that existed. I think I was threading Black feminist thought. I was threading dance. I was threading what I knew of my own culture and my own desire and attempts to reconnect to my culture. I started just weaving all of that together. And that started to help me articulate this thing, which is still an emerging thing, but understanding that one, the way we think about change in ourselves of like, if I have an idea, if I think of something, if I have an insight, then I should be able to do it.
Oh, wow.
And discovering like, no, that's not how it works. That we practice things. We're always practicing something. You practice how you are every day. You refine it. You get better at it. Your protective strategies, you refine them. You like tweak them a little bit. Okay, I can protect myself a little bit better this way. You become an expert in that thing. And so if we want to change something or do something differently, we have to practice with that kind of attention. But then I started to notice too, you know, there was that sort of revelation for me. But then noticing if I looked back both at my life and, you know, people that came before me, they were always practicing. Singing, dancing, you know, seasonal practices. That this wasn't just like stuff to pass the time, but it was about readying ourselves for moments, transitions, collectively tying in. You know, you can sync your heartbeats and your breath together so that you can coordinate more easily. So when I started to look back on that, I was like, oh, we're just always practicing, but we're unaware of our practicing. And we're so outside of our own bodies and so outside of our own sensations that we don't know what we're practicing. And what I'm doing is illuminating something that people have known for a really long time, just saying it now.
As you work with groups and also as you just like observe larger collective structures, I'm moved by the we don't know what we're practicing. We can name some of the things we affirm and want to practice, but kind of unconsciously, what are some of the things you see people practicing that we are not aware of that like we should maybe interrogate a little deeper?
Uh-oh.
No, this is a real one.
Uh-oh. I think one that people are most comfortable talking about is kind of like, I think what we might call overwork, but I think some of it, I think a lot of our strategies that we get practice in are actually about numbing our feeling. So I think people practice, you know, not allowing for feeling because it feels like overwhelming, all encompassing or uncomfortable and our threshold is really low. So I think that's one way. And again, I can only speak from like places in movement where I have been. I think sometimes we're practiced in mistrust. I think we're practiced in talking about each other. I think we're practiced in, as opposed to like directly engaging in conflict or engaging in conflict, even with a twinge of curiosity, where I think some of us can be practiced in like talking shit. Yeah, I mean, there's so many different kinds of numbing. And I think we don't understand that the great resource that feeling is. It's where I think it's part of the root of our power is to be able to feel and allow feeling. But yeah, I think there are a million different strategies that people undertake in order to avoid that.
How do those different practices of numbing inhibit or limit the possibilities of our movement work?
Well, I want to offer a disclaimer, which is that I'm not saying numbing is bad. And I think that's an important thing to say. It's not bad necessarily because we feel when we have the resource to feel or perceive that we have the resource to feel. If we do not perceive or actually have the resource to feel, we won't do it. And that might be the best decision in that moment, given conditions. So I want to say that. I think the challenge is when it becomes a habit and we're no longer choiceful in whether or not we're doing that. That's the challenge of everything. That's when we're doing something out of habit, we're doing something out of like, something happened and I learned a thing and I'm just going to take that lesson to every single moment and I will lose access to my ability to assess opportunity or difference or all these things. So feeling, I say it's the root of our power in part because one, if most of me can feel the same thing at the same time, that creates a kind of integrity and congruence, conviction that is palpable. It not only makes my movements, and I don't mean that just in a physicality, but the actions I take, more powerful, congruent, aligned. It also conveys relationally where I am, and it can compel other people to look into that. Oh, that looks, hey, that person looks convicted about that thing. That looks interesting to me. That can be a powerful thing to witness when somebody's on expressing something so viscerally. But a lot of times, because of past experiences or because we don't really believe or feel, we can be expressing any number of things at the same time. Like, we can be expressing that way, but actually this way. Parts of us can be expressing contradictory things. And it's not actually that compelling in terms of power. It's not that congruent. The other thing about feeling, you were talking about earlier, Daniel, you were saying like, sometimes we're actually 30% that kind of nuance that exists in feeling. Reactivity doesn't understand nuance. Reactivity is binary. It's yes or no, safe, not safe. Feeling is where nuance and complexity, and therefore, in my opinion, precision can live. It's in the space of feeling. And that's why I think feeling, it gives us ability to kind of, again, see options, see, oh, if I just do this, I don't have to move all the way at 90 degrees, but I can just do this other degree that's more precise. I think feeling actually allows us to do that. And when I say feeling, I mean when we're not resisting what's happening in our bodies, when we allow that information to move through us and we bring a sort of conscious attention to what's happening. To me, that is the process of feeling what is. And there's so much happening, so much being communicated all the time. And I like to sit really close to my own sensations as much as possible, because that tells me I'm having a good time here. I'm not having a good time here. I'm pulling away this way. I'm not pulling away. There's a distinction there that I don't want to get into. I'm not talking about navel gazing or kind of self-consciousness. Like, am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? I'm talking about living from a place of listening in. And I can really relate from that place. It's more of a supple place for me.
Yeah, I had a conversation with my therapist who was saying, like, the thing about feelings is that you don't think them, you feel them. And like, you have to listen to that. That's really different. And sometimes the reactivity is, at least for me, gets me very stuck in the thinking in response to it. It's like, okay, why did I do that? How do I change that behavior? Like, and there's this moment of intervention in there that it sounds like you're talking to, of like, outside of that binary of either I snapped back and reacted or I didn't. There's a lot of other things going on in there. And so how do I be more precise? One, about like how I might want to respond, but also about just what am I sitting here right now? Like, what is actually happening here, you know?
And this is, I think, at the essence of what I see to be our generations and future and past generations, like, central question around how to create, nurture, and sustain movement spaces or collective spaces in general. But certainly, I think it's more important to me in liberatory movement spaces. As we kind of take inventory of those feelings and interpersonally and the way in which they are aligned, congruent, or disjointed, that process is not only happening within one body, right? Like, most of the rooms we are trying to create is multiple bodies with conflicting, contradictory feelings that folks maybe have different levels of practice of listening into. And so in my observation over these last 10 years, and I, you know, my study of the last century of Black people trying to get free, is that dissension, internal fracture. So there seems to be three things that happen, right? There is the state and repression, co-optation and like bleed into, trickle into kind of the mainstream, and then loss of focus or drift. And then there's internal conflict. And I feel like we have a lot of literature about COINTELPRO and about the state and about, you know, the war machine. We have a lot of understanding about sellouts and about the DNC, and like, we know how to critique that. But I feel like we are just as ill-equipped in 2024 as we were in 1924 of how to keep people in a room together. And even now, I don't even see a lot of ideological conflict, right? It's not like, I'm a Leninist. No, I'm a Trotskyite. I'm sure ideology plays out, but it's mostly what I see is the personal and the way that feelings show up and the way that is discomforting to go beyond your capacity, to do things you don't know, to be around people that you're building different layers of trust with. And so now I'm preaching to give my testimony.
It's a good one. It's a good one.
Yeah. I really want to get to the question of like, and we have to work together. How do we go in this process of reconciling contradictory feelings amongst a body of people that often we are still getting to know, that are holding their own contradictory feelings, and not project that onto the space or onto others? Because that's what I see a lot of, is like, I'm uncomfortable and therefore this place is unfair to me, or I have been wronged because this does not feel good. What practices can we build to work through that fracturing that seems to happen everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, that was an incredible question. In the framing of it, I think the wisdom of the framing of it and the difficulty of the question makes it feel kind of exciting for us to think about together. It's a hard one. Exactly what you're saying. The projection piece, the fact that many of us, unbeknownst to ourselves, are trying to resolve history in the present. It's challenging to, when we're in an organizational context, to sufficiently speak to each other across time. And I'm not even sure that that is actually the responsibility of me in this moment or you in this moment to know how to speak to each other across time in that setting. So that makes the question really hard. What I have come to so far, and I would love to hear what you all kind of think about this from your perspectives, is that I actually think we need places to do that, that are not just our organizations. We've been playing with this terminology in our organization of like, and I don't know that it will stick, but you know, people have political homes. They also need sort of like healing homes or homes where they can understand their time traveling self and what they're trying to resolve. For some people, some of us, it's therapy. I mean, I have a therapist. I have more than one therapist, if I'm honest. But I also think there's something to the collective practice and to understand that work in community and towards liberation. I think there's something to that. I'm not sure that all of our political homes, I think our political homes have to have aspects that are resilient, that are healing, that are all of these things that are structured on these principles. And I think we need places because some of it for me, when I look at my own life, where I didn't get some of the things I needed was when I look at the context of growing up in the 80s during, you know, the war on drugs and how it broke apart my community. It had deep implications for our culture and the way that we use our culture. And I don't mean like use it like an object, but I mean, what dance and how we use dance, what song and how we use song, what practices and how we use them. We have songs and dances, but do we use them according to the need? And do we have the ability to do that? So there's this whole question to me of like what culture once did, what our homes once did. And I'm not being in like a traditionalist sense, but I'm just saying there are things that are lost that actually help a human being to grow a wide emotional range and allow us to process the things that have happened. I think a lot of people that I work with, including myself, I did not have those spaces. I did not have that kind of development. And we need that kind of development. So I think that's one of it. I can give you practices and tools. I facilitate people through conflict and conflict that feels intractable. But what actually moves it is when people understand what they're doing a little bit more. And they understand what they're trying to resolve. And they, you know, one of the things I always prep people with is like, you might not feel satisfied on the end of this facilitation around this conflict, because what you're trying to satisfy cannot actually be satisfied here. So how can we go into it knowing there's a level of, this is activating something that might not get fully addressed. And what's the best I can do to move through here with breath, with while maintaining other people's dignity, while being honest, you know, there's so much here. I mean, we could go on for days, but I think that's part of the challenge for me.
That's powerful. The expectation and comfort with lingering dissatisfaction as like a prerequisite or a preparedness that we move into this with. And so I'm hearing this notion of healing home, which one, I was going to say, I'll speak for us. I'll let you speak for yourself, Dave. I think we like that. I think we're super for that and love the imagination of just infrastructure at large. And so I want to talk about it as infrastructure in the larger framework of healing infrastructure. And what relationship do you imagine this notion of healing home happening with the organizational or political home? Because I want to bring in a question from my partner, Jennifer Pagan, and movement leader with Let's Breathe Collective, who's a big fan, feels weird, but like a big appreciator of your work. Similar to my question of fracturing.
Yeah.
Usually what we see, there's a pattern of folks say like, I am going to go heal, or I need to step back. I need to leave. I need to separate, to go recoup, to go heal, to go recover. And so does that feel like what should be? Like maybe we need that healing to happen separately, or does this healing home, is this like a house on the estate of liberation, or is it like in a different, you know, county?
Come on, Liberation Estate. I definitely think a healing home is on the Liberation Estate for sure. And I think should be deeply connected to movement, should be deeply connected to political organizations, should be supportive of those movements. I feel like our work has maintained deep connections and relationships to Black movement and Black movement infrastructure, and that means something to us and what we do. And I think it is an indicator, you know, when people are like, I have to go heal. I think I understand what troubles us about that, you know, to have to leave movement. And I think it's also an indicator of some of it. I can't say all of it, but some of it is an indicator that something about the way we're doing it is not working. So what needs to switch up? What needs to change? What do we need to shift? You know, sometimes again, these conversations with people and they're like, oh, all these people are annoying with all their feelings and then they got to go somewhere. And I get it. And don't miss what it is that you need to look at about that. Don't miss what is the teaching for our movements at large. I think there's something, I don't know what it is because this is actually not my domain, but I think there's some kind of switch up that has to happen around how we're organizing because it's not working for a lot of people on multiple levels. And please, organizers, don't come. Don't at me.
Oh, they know.
Okay.
They know it ain't working. At yourself.
Anyone who's actually
something's
organizing
going on.
At us. Don't at us.
Yeah, don't at me. At David and Daniel. You know, I said to someone once, I was like, I hope that our movement starts to feel like life. And you're talking about infrastructure. I'm like, yeah, because we talk about building the thing. It's like healing homes, my organization, a million other organizations, however many organizations we need, the right number that are not redundant. We need what we need and it needs to look like life. It needs to feel life-giving to people. We need to have the kind of infrastructure. People come and they're like, oh yeah, this is a place where I can get down. This has what I need. And this is a part of building that, uncovering that next world, building that however we want to talk about it. Yeah, I don't want people to have to leave. And they do currently. So something ain't hitting the way we want it to. But yeah, we're on the estate. We're in the same, I don't know what it is. I don't know what the right word is.
Cute little cottage over there,
yeah,
on the side of
exactly.
The field.
Yep, yep,
yep. I want to go back to something that you were talking about as part of your previous answer, of thinking about the role of different cultural practice, different cultural traditions, singing, but singing toward what? Dancing toward what? And this feeling of something being lost. And you made this distinction of like, you're not talking about a traditionalist, like, you know, the nuclear family and the music where everyone dances in couples. Like, that's not what we're talking about. But part of what it just rang true for me, you know, so I got married in October. And in thinking about what songs we'd want to dance to,
mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm,
they all came out before 1978, you know? And some of that is because I've been a 65-year-old man since I was 12, but I think there's something in there. And so I'm wondering, like, can you speak a little bit more to what you feel like is lost in the, you know, dancing toward what?
Man, I'm gonna sound like a fully an old head right now, which I am, because it's just is the way it is at this point. I'm certainly not saying that those qualities that I'm looking for don't exist in the way we do culture right now, but I think that we have been intercepted by corporate interest. Our culture has been intercepted. In that way, the power of what it could be has been intercepted too. I'm not saying that there's not good music, good art, good everything. There is, and I enjoy it all the time. But I'm saying on the whole, by and large, there's been an interception where maybe there was like a lot of folks who didn't even pay attention to, you know, music that was being created that had that kind of soul to it. They were like, oh, we can use this. We can make a bunch of money off of this. Okay, there was an interception that happened. And I think that culture, the way that we've done it for a long time, it's intended to have a purpose for the people. It's intended to align with the needs of people, moments in people's lives. There's so much, again, we're talking about nuance, like the emotional nuance that I think has been available to us at different points in time. And the narrow emotional stories that we're able to tell right now, it's really, really narrow and narrowing of our emotional perception, our emotional lives, our sense of community, our sense of like purpose and justice. I think there has been an intentional interception and narrowing of that through our culture over time. And, you know, I was talking to an elder who was saying, like, back in the 60s and the 70s, we used to just walk down the street and sing. Everybody was singing. And I was thinking, like, wow, what about a community being in that kind of ritual all the time? Everybody's dancing and singing, where everybody feels like it's possible for them to dance and sing, walk into each other's houses. Like, what actually was the connective pulse in a community that could do that. And I look back, it wasn't happening when I was coming up, but I can see that it happened for generations before me. What would that do if we felt like we could do that, that culture was something that was just always the heartbeat, always kind of underneath things. And we knew how to sing the right song when somebody was having a baby, or sing the right song when somebody was dying. To me, that is what culture is supposed to do. It is a technology that is about answering or speaking to the very human experiences that we have in the range of them. And when it is intercepted, it co-opts the range that we can actually feel. It co-opts our lives in a particular way. And that's where I feel concerned. I mean, and I'm like, we need to recover dances, but we also need to create them. We need to remember and we need to reinvent. There's some new dances. There's dances that we have to create together that have never been danced before. And a lot of us feel like shy about, I don't want to do some weird shit. We have to create the things that we need.
Move those hips.
Exactly.
We're big fans of hip movement.
Oh, okay.
I mean, we're being a little silly, but actually, like, in recognizing that, like, oppression and power, like, stiffens the hips. And so
absolutely,
there's like a reason why cis men and white people as two groups, and also overlapping groups, like, can't dance as well. And like, it shows up in the body in that way.
I have a whole thing about that. We have to be rhythmic people. We're not going to win if we're not rhythmic, you know, because the whole thing that we're like oppressed by, it's not a rhythmic system. There's no ups and downs. There's no cycles. It's just constant profit margin. That is an unrhythmic system.
Like a musical drone, yeah, almost.
Exactly.
But just one quick thought on what you just shared of there's the interception in people's collective behavior of that singing together. And then there's also just how that interception individualized all those processes, right? I think people still have an understanding of like what this song evokes for me, or like how it's cathartic when I'm feeling grief or sad to put on this song, music especially, is I think what I'm talking about. But, you know, the process of listening to music is individualized in a way that it wasn't before, which there's beauty in that intimacy. Like, I'm not taking that away. I mean, that's something that I value a lot as someone who's talking into a microphone. But I do think, like, that's part of that interception too, is like, if we're saying, you know, the way we understand healing has been, you know, intercepted and individualized, I think also the way we interact with culture in that process has also been individualized, because you can sell something to a person in a different way.
Thank you. That's great.
Anyway, that was my little soapbox that you made me think of.
I think I got one to squeeze in.
Let's do it.
That we can close with. And so, you know, in the opening, and I think throughout, right, like this notion of lineage has kind of wrapped this conversation, and I think wraps your work in a really swaddled way. And I want to just give some time as we close out, and hopefully we can do this again at some point in the not too distant future. I want to talk about embodiment lineage, healing lineage, as you know and imagine them. So, you know, the lineage of the so-called past that you honor and see yourself coming out of, and the future lineage of embodiment work and healing work. Like, how do you know and imagine that continuum in a way that, like, you invite other peoples to think about it with you?
Oh, wow. Yeah, we just keep remembering the thing that they keep trying to cover up. I've seen it across many different generations of even somatics itself, you know, and I think about, you know, there's a long anti-authoritarian, there's the somatics that they teach in schools, and then there are the people that really moved even that canon forward, always held that at the core. And I feel deeply inspired by that and still learning into those lineages. And then I reach back and I think about culture. I think about my ancestors. I think about my family. I think about the things that we hold on to and the things that we've lost. So I feel very much rooted in that lineage. You know, I'm just like brushing away something. I'm trying to like clear something up that in this moment has been obscured. That's all that I'm trying to do, is like clear it up and have us practice together, because I don't know the answers. And I hope, my desire is for somebody else, to many somebodies, to just keep uncovering. There's so much I can't even perceive. I don't even know it. I don't even know that it's there. I hope that, you know, we'll just keep clearing the path, and rejoicing at the person or peoples who came before us that cleared a little bit of space for us. And I rejoice, you know, in advance for those who are clearing the path in the future, because it's fun.
Is there anybody who you've uncovered that you want to like just name or celebrate or have reverence for as we close out?
As teachers?
That folks should look into? Like you say, you've been doing this uncovering and there's...
Yeah, I hesitate because everybody's complicated. You know what I mean? So I don't want y'all being like, Brent just said this person wasn't complicated. I'm telling you, everybody's complicated. But, you know, I think all Black feminist teachings of Audre Lorde as an example, that is embodiment teaching. That is embodiment. That is writing embodied. I mean, she talks about feelings and bodies. That is embodiment. But I think Black feminist work is so situated for me in the body. And those are really teachers of mine. And then I think if we want to look at somatics, I think there's complicated people, but you know, you can look at the work of Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen, or you can look at the work of Continuum. Scratch this question, because there's so many people that I want to say, and I'm like, everybody's names are escaping me.
We did name everybody. Thank you for giving just those few references. Okay.
As we get out of here, how can folks uncover your work in the ways that you would like it to be uncovered? Where can people find you in the ways you want to be found?
That's a great question. The best way to find me and us is at the Embodiment Institute, theembodimentinstitute.org, where we're practicing together multiple times a month around a lot of the things that we were discussing here, but we're in practice moving our bodies together. So that's a great place to find what we're doing. You can follow me on Instagram if you like. If you like to follow people who rarely post, you can follow me at Prentice Hemphill there. I will have a book coming out in June called What It Takes to Heal, which is talking about individual and collective transformation. And so look out for that. Our books are sold.
Get the book. Get a pre-orders are a thing everyone gets excited about. Pre-order. No, there you go.
This is a time to pre-order. It's out for pre-order. So if you feel inclined, please do.
And as we go, I just want to thank you and your community and your lineage for the work that you've done. Me and Daniel both grew up playing sports, so that the notion of practice makes a lot of sense. But when you go to a practice, there's usually someone who models the drill or models the play or models the body movement before you do it. So thank you so much for being an example and a model and a coach in terms of how we build up our practices and get towards new habits so we can transform ourselves in the world. It really has left an impact. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And even if you don't put this part in the podcast, just thank you both so much for that. I'm receiving that. And thank you for the real thoughtfulness of your questions. They made me feel excited to talk to you both. And I'm just really, really grateful. I can tell whatever you both touch is needed. So thank you.
Appreciate that. And we'll be back reshaping culture for the more liberatory and creative.
Let's do it.
Peace.
Much love to the people.